Welcome back to New Books in Gender Studies. I am the co-host of the channel, Lillian Barger. Today, my conversation is with Lee Fott, an assistant professor of history at Le Moyne College. Her book, Women in the World of Frederick Douglass, published by Oxford University Press, is a topic of this show. Fott offers us a detailed and rich portrait of Frederick Douglass's private and public life and his relationship with many women in his world. From his enslaved mother, Harriet, Sophia Ault, the slave mistress, that sparked his interest in reading, to his wife of 44 years, Anna Murray, daughter Rosetta, and his white second wife, Helen Pitts. These were the women who populated his private world. From each, he learned lessons about the workings of race, gender, and class in America, and prepared him to collaborate with many anti-slavery women, including Maria Weston Chapman, Amy Post, and Julia Griffiths. He saw his fight for abolition as part of women's cause that brought him into contact with Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony. Seeing himself as a women's rights man who attended the Seneca Falls Women's Rights Convention in 1848, he was perplexed by the betrayal of many women's rights advocates. Fott fills in much of what is lacking in the female empty space in the study of Douglass, allowing a fuller understanding of his life and ideas. This is an invaluable contribution to Douglass studies. Here is my conversation with Lee Fott. Now, let me introduce you to the author, Lee Fott. Hello, Lee.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Welcome to the show, and thank you for sharing your thoughts with our audience. Your book makes a tremendous contribution in filling much of what is ignored and overlooked in the study of Frederick Douglass, which I never really noticed before. It's kind of odd that I didn't notice it before. But before we get into the book, tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and how you came to write Women in the World of Frederick Douglass.
Well, let's see. My background is a little eclectic, not wildly eclectic, but I started out actually studying colonial history and then moved over into the 19th century. It's kind of funny. I thought I wasn't interested in anything after 1800. And then I took a class in history after 1800 and I realized, wow, this is amazing. Then I moved into Southern history, I think because I was trying to understand my own family's past. My first book was about somebody who was probably about as far away from Frederick Douglass as you could get and still be in the 19th century. I mean, a slaveholding white woman who was not a woman's rights woman. And I always joke that she reminded me of my grandmother and a powerful woman, but not quite what you'd expect. And after writing about her, I wanted to spend time in the mind of somebody who I could admire. And I ended up working at the Frederick Douglass Papers. And we were publishing the letters, the kind of the first maybe 10 years of the correspondence of Frederick Douglass. And I had to annotate, which is, you know, explain what he's talking about or who he's writing about to somebody who's just wanting to look at his letters and refer to them or research in them, but doesn't want to do all of the background research. For instance, when he says, I saw Joe and who's Joe? I would research who Joe was or Josephine. As it turned out, and those were the women, you know, when I started to see how many women he was referring to and doing all of that research and seeing, you know, the women were the ones who were interesting me. And I started to notice how many of them were around him and how much work they were doing. And then I took kind of a detour on my career path, became an archivist for a little while, went to library school, but really I found out I was a historian and I wanted to tell the stories of the documents, not organize the documents. And Douglass just would not let me go. The women, and so when I got back on the academic track, I was working at a community college and I didn't have to research and I didn't have to write. And this book, I just kept thinking about, I want to write about these women who are around Douglass. I want to write this book. Why not? And so 8 years ago, I decided, let's do it. You know, if I die and haven't done this, I'm going to regret it. And so I did. And it became a thing. And so that's what brought me to it. But what it was seeing all these women who were drawn to him and kind of being one of them myself and wanting to tell that story.
You're right. I want to go on to something else here. Your book is addressing a problem in scholarship regarding Douglass. Can you talk a little bit about that problem and why that problem has existed? What is the problem that your book is filling?
When I started to look at these women, and then, of course, you go to the secondary sources to look, where are these women? What have other people said? For a long time, nobody wrote about these women because you left the women out of the stories for most of the 20th century. He wrote about them. If you look in his autobiographies, he's paying tribute to them. He's paying tribute to them in a very public way because, I mean, he never, he addressed the work that they did, that they're known for, that they wanted to be known for. But it was like the biographers kind of didn't even address that. They didn't address, they might mention his second wife because she was white, and that was a note, and contrast her to the first wife who was black. But they didn't mention women. It was like women weren't important in the abolitionist movement, women were in the background. Then as women's history started to become a field and people started to realize that, oh, hey, you know, women did do things in history that mattered, and not just the great women who are on the stage, but women, you know, collectively were a force in history. When biographers started to try to incorporate women into his life, they did it in really clumsy ways. It was like they didn't quite know how to deal with women in his life. It was almost like they were caught between that public and private dichotomy, that public sphere, private sphere. Public was where the real work was done. Private was domestic. And even when, one of his biographers, William McFeely, tried that, there's still this flip-flop feeling to it. He's out here doing this great stuff in public, and then he goes home and he does this. And he's out here doing this among men, and then he goes home and there's his wife and his kids. And there was no connection between the two. And then even when there were women out there in that public sphere among men, women like Julia Griffiths, women like Maria Weston Chapman, who were part of that work, it was like, what do you do with them there? They were there. Okay, what were they doing? And the type of work they were doing, they weren't on stage necessarily giving talks. They weren't doing necessarily the same kind of work he was doing, but they were out there. I mean, when you started to look at the literature on abolitionist women, then you could see the work that they were doing. And it wasn't necessarily sexy work. It was fundraising. And it was necessary. And in fact, it was actually quite exciting to see how they were integrating. They were at the cutting edge of integrating their organizations racially. They raised the money and they made sure that these men could be on stage and women could be on stage. They made sure that the halls got rented, that the newspapers covered their shortfalls. They did all of this work. And so these biographers didn't seem to know how to integrate this. And that became very frustrating. So when I flipped the point of view, when I decided, okay, let's just look at the women and what the women are doing. And then you start to see where it's not, as women's historians have been debating for the past 10, 15, 20 years, it isn't this public-private divide. The two things interact. And even though they did live in a period of time in which there was, and we still deal with what do we want to be public and what do we want to be private, and they did live in a time that tried to divide things into what's okay to be in public and what is domestic, they manipulated that. And the two things worked together. And so they had already known before they even named it. I mean, it was the feminists in the 1970s who named it, but the personal was political. And so that's when you started to look at it from the women's point of view, then you started to see that element of his activism and the important roles they played, not just kind of the material roles, but every role they played.
Now, what's interesting about Douglass, of course, is that we have treated him in my circles, because I'm an intellectual historian, we treat him and his intellectual thought, so we put a lot of emphasis on what he wrote, and we tend to totally ignore the rest of his life. And you're talking about women being, you know, you're talking about the private role of women, how they interact with him. But he had, from your book, he had women who were intellectual partners, yep. Women that he exchanged ideas with. They weren't just, supporting him in very concrete ways. They also had their own ideas. And those are the women that I'm very, like, interested in really talking about. But I want to go back to what the lapse is, or where the holes are in this history of scholarship on Douglass. And you did talk about how Douglass talked about these women in his work. Mm-hmm. He mentions them. He, you know, gives them their due. But how much did he feed that marginalization of the women, particularly some of his more intellectual partners?
Yeah, well, a lot of that, I mean, I hate to fall into the cliche of this. It was the time.
Yeah, right.
A lot of it. But again, there is this dangerous, you know, it was the time. There was this dangerous game that a lot of them are playing in moving, you know, first of all, they're challenging what women should be or could be. And there is always the danger of when you step out of that, especially if you're stepping out of that, like a lot of the things he was coming up against and the women he was with, like, well, I guess the most common example is him and Julia Griffiths, and how their very public role together working in the North Star office became fodder for a scandal. So if you had to be very careful that if you went too far, somebody could always come back at you and make you suddenly not respectable and discredit everything you're trying to do. And Douglass himself, like a lot of the women he's working with, is very, very wedded to these politics of respectability, of putting up this respectable front, a respectable family, and not just the front, but also internalizing it.
Because he had another agenda besides moving women forward, or black men and women forward in the public realm. He also wanted to show, I think especially with the chapter that you talk about his wife, Anna Murray, how he was trying to show that black women, black families could function in, you know, the tradition, what we consider now the traditional middle class way of life, with a woman being at home and being domestic and doing things and supporting her husband in the public realm. So he was trying to do a couple of things at the same time.
Yeah.
Right. So let's talk about his relationship with his wife, Anna Murray, who he was married to for 44 years.
Yeah.
And the interesting juxtaposition between him and her, and how their relationship worked. They had, it was like a joint project, and and their home was a model. They were trying to make their home sort of a model of what African-American people could achieve.
Yes, very much.
Okay, so talk about her. I think she's very interesting.
Oh, she is interesting. Well, the first thing that, I mean, dealing with her, this was a woman who did not want me to know her. I mean, I don't think she wanted anyone to know her. She chose who would know her. And as a historian trying to pry into her life, I just would have visions of, like, I'll die and I'll go over to the other side and she'll be sitting there waiting for me and she'll slap me. I mean, she struck me as this very private person. I mean, even when you read her daughter's memoir of her, to her daughter, she was a very private person. So she kept a lot to herself. So she was hard to get at. But trying to understand where she's coming from, I had to, you know, in a lot of trying doing this is where were these women coming from, which I don't think any of his biographers that even the ones who try to deal with the women have sat down and said, okay, what did these women bring to this relationship and where, what is their point of view in it? And from her, I had to start with where she's coming from, what are, were her options. When she was 26 years old and a single woman in Baltimore and looking forward in her life, when she meets this young man who's a slave, what options does she have in her life? And what would she want in her life? And in all likelihood, she would want her own kind of independence. She wouldn't want to be a domestic in somebody else's house. And she would want to be able to have a husband and children and be mistress in her own house and raise her own children and have a certain level of financial security, even if she did have to do some work, you know, have her children have a better life. And, you know, here comes this kind of, I always imagine him as having a little bit of swagger, smart, ambitious young man, and he's going to offer her this future, possibly. I mean, it was a huge risk for her to take, to pin her future on this young slave and run away to the North, cutting off her whole family.
She was free. She was a free woman.
She was free. And so she took this huge risk to run away with him. And when they started off, you know, what kind of future did they see? And I don't think of it as some great love story. I see it as, you know, you have these skills and I have these skills and we want these things out of life. And yeah, let's go for it. And so they start off, you know, essentially this working class family in a Black community. And the game changed radically within a couple of years. And she had to react to that. And he became, you know, when they get to, I mean, the thing to think about, I mean, when they got together, he didn't even know who Shakespeare was to know that this was some, you know, much less that he liked Shakespeare, much less that in 10 years he's going to be in front of huge crowds and quoting Shakespeare second only to the Bible. So how are they going to know that, you know, in 10 years that's going to happen? And she's like most of my students, Shakespeare leaves them cold, if that's making any sense. That is, you know, here they are, they get together, and then this huge change happens, and he discovers something about himself that she's, you know, she's not interested in.
Now what happens when they get married, of course, and he gets his freedom, and there's a long process there, but he becomes, you know, a very public person. She remains a very private person, and she has to deal with all his public persona, how the public is sort of looking at them and examining them to see if they're, you know, okay in terms of do they meet the standards of what was considered respectability at that point. They have guests in their home continually. She's got to take care of the children and have an orderly home. She also does not read. She's illiterate. She has a whole, and she's cast into the sort of public role that she doesn't really want. And the intrusion of the public into their life, constantly wanting to know, you know, what's going on in there, since people are coming in and out all the time. Talk about her feelings, particularly when it comes to Julia Griffith and who she is and how she gets involved with Douglas and how she ends up in their home.
Yeah.
Which I was like, okay, it's a little much to ask, you know?
Yeah, well, and that's the thing is, you know, what a lot of people, when they come at this, they look at the Julia Griffith, it's like, oh, yeah, you know, and you start to hear bong, chicka, bow, bow, and they want to get into like, oh, there's something sexual going on there. And that's why Anna was upset. And I'm probably jumping ahead for anyone who's listening. So what happens is, you know, this is – Frederick becomes famous, and like you said, all of this attention is coming to their family. And on top of that, there is a certain level of, you've got all these white people in the North who don't usually see Black people, And they see when they see, and then when they think of Black people, their image of Black people is from minstrel shows. So they see the Douglas family, and there's a certain level of kind of curiosity. Like, let's go, we want to see this. We want to, there's a Black person in town. Let's go see this. And that's, well, a little bit racist and a little bit disconcerting and a little bit frustrating and infuriating. And she's got to hold all this off, plus all the people Frederick's bringing. And she's got to hold all this off because she's there protecting the privacy of their family because, you know, you don't want all of this intrusion. And then Frederick is sometimes at odds with that because he's inviting all these people to come in. And the way I always saw it, you know, there is this line in the house that they seem, and this is just my theory, that they seem to be negotiating as to where that line is between public and private, or semi-public and semi-private. What, how far do you let outsiders in, and which outsiders? And it really comes to a head when Douglas ends up with very important friendships that press up against the kind of borders that a wife would be really potent for a wife. So Frederick Douglas has this woman. It actually begins her and her sister, along with several other people living in the Douglas household, who are there to support him as he begins his paper, The North Star, in Rochester. Julia Griffiths especially is the one who, I mean, she's one of the most important people in making sure he becomes the Frederick Douglass we know. She comes in with business acumen, publishing expertise. She's clearly very well educated. She's got this background. She's got overseas connections. She plugs into a group of women who are not very well organized and brings them together and organizes them to support the newspaper as well as kind of a different anti-slavery agenda in Western New York. So she's really quite instrumental in the abolitionist movement in Western New York as well as in supporting Douglas. So she's quite a powerhouse. And she was one of the first people I was really incredibly interested in around him. And so she comes in from England and she steps in and helps him save the paper. Her sister marries the printer who was already living in the house and they leave. Some of the other people who are living in the household also leave. So it's left the Douglas family and Julia Griffiths. They go to work together all day. They're in the North Star office doing business. They come home at a time when Anna could reasonably expect Douglas, her husband, to pay attention to household matters and the family. And Julie Griffiths is still there. And they go up to his office and they continue to work on business. And so from Anna's point of view, okay, this is our time, our family time, and you're still doing business time. No. And so this creates a tension as to who Douglas thinks it's okay to have in the house, and he should have his entitlement and his right to have who he wants in the house as his friend and doing what's necessary to keep the business going, which keeps that roof over their head. And Anna saying, can't she go live somewhere else? And you need to pay attention to the family. I mean, great, she's helping the business going in the roof of the head, but you need to attend to what's under the roof. And so this kind of creates this tension of him being head of the household, but her being head in the household. And I kind of wonder how many families had that kind of tension going on. And eventually Griffith does move to another household because, again, this starts to call attention. They have a lot of enemies within the movement, and this starts to call that attention. It becomes something that those enemies can use against Douglas and Griffiths. William Lloyd Garrison does use it. So then that calls more public attention, bad public attention, calls into question their respectability So it calls it, it threatens kind of what Anna and Douglas are doing together, creating this respectable family. And it draws her then into the public sphere when she gets called upon to defend the family in the pages of the Liberator. Like, okay, this is not what she bargained for at all. In fact, this is not, something has gone terribly awry for her.
Now, you mentioned a lot of women in your book. There's so many. I was just like, wow. Yeah. I mean, there's all kinds of women working with him, traveling with him, supporting his work, working in the office, lecturing, going out lecturing with him. They buy his freedom. Women buy his freedom. He, you know, women are really very involved in supporting his work. And one thing that you talk about is that he was a very attractive man for women.
Yeah.
He was powerful. He was a big guy, and he was just kind of attractive or intriguing, right?
Yeah.
And that probably didn't help him because other people could notice that women were drawn to him.
Oh, yeah. In fact, that started to really be the letters coming over from England. The Boston Public Library has this great anti-slavery collection, and these are all the Garrisonians, the American Anti-Slavery Society based in Boston. And they're kind of keeping tabs on him while he's in England the first time. And they're all writing back saying, oh, my God, the women are throwing themselves at him. The women are making fools of themselves over him. One guy says something to the effect, it's Richard Webb, who's an Irish abolitionist in Dublin, and he has a very tart tongue. His letters are always hilarious because he's kind of, you know, very catty. And he's writing to Maria Weston Chapman in Boston, and she's very catty. And so they're fun, very, well, certain words kind of letters to read. And he's actually kind of dismayed that a lot of these women are joining the abolitionists, or, you know, Douglas is gaining a lot of, you know, followers to the abolitionist movement, but he's really dismayed. He thinks they're only joining for him, not for the cause.
In other words, he's a rock star.
Yeah, it's like they don't love the cause, they just love him. This is but one of the women, Isabel Jennings, she's one of his good friends, and she's in Cork, Ireland. She's actually a character in Col McCann's Transatlantic. That's one of the characters he chose to focus on in the novel. But she says, you know, he is so proper. He's in holding these women off. You know, he's doing all he can. You know, he's being a gentleman. They're the ones making fools of themselves. And but, you know, his charisma is what brought, you know, men wouldn't talk this way, but, you know, it brought men to the audience. It's what brought, it's what drew people to him. And it would be more acceptable for women to act that way than for men to act that way. But men were drawn to him. And you see men, you know, it becomes an alpha male competition with men as to who's going to be the leader, the black leader. But I mean, there's that book of photographs of him that you look at that, he's got that charisma and that, you know, just attractiveness that still is compelling across a century and a half.
Now, his, the other person that you talk about a lot, which I found very interesting, was his daughter, Rosetta.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of reasons why she's interesting. And one of them, of course, is she's being raised in a completely new way.
Yeah.
The extended family, the Douglas's extended family that comes together after abolition and they kind of reconnect with each other. She doesn't seem to fit. I mean, anywhere. She doesn't fit with white people. She doesn't fit with her own African American people. She's just sort of at a loss. Can you talk about her? I really felt a lot for her because I thought she was a transitional figure.
Yes, yes. She, there is, you know, and I felt for her, I mean, but my first connected to her as the oldest daughter in a family of sons, because I'm the oldest daughter in a family of sons. But also, there's no model for her. There is no, you know, a generation later, 10 years later, there might have been. But there is no model for her of a respectable Black woman. You know, where is this woman for her?
Educated,
raising a family. I mean, she's none of this is around her. And she's kind of torn between, she's very much a daddy's girl. And who wouldn't look up to this father? She wants to please him. It's easy for her brothers because, you know, you go and you be a man like dad. You go and you fight in the Civil War. But if you're a girl, you can't go and be like dad, and you don't have any female versions of dad. And then you have a mother who's very much a traditional woman. And the kind of women that intellectually stimulate dad are white women, and they're always passing through when they're not raising families. And she seems to also want to raise a family. I mean, she does have all those daughters. And so it's like she's torn. And when she does venture out and try to go out on her own and teach in New Jersey, in Philadelphia, in New Jersey, and she's just astounded by how nasty the upper class Black bourgeoisie is in Philadelphia, and how nasty people can be when she goes to teach poor students. And she's, you know, I kind of got why she decided, let me get married and try to strike out over here.
But she did. She seems to marry beneath her status.
Yeah.
Which causes problems for her.
Yeah.
Because she can never really get away from her father.
Yeah. Well, I don't think she wants to get away from her father. That's the thing. I think in a certain way, she may have seen herself as stepping into a role like, say Kate Chase Sprague did for her father, or Fannie Stewart did for William Seward. Fannie Stewart did for William Seward. You're like, you have these, or even Martha Jefferson Jr., Martha Jefferson Randolph did for Thomas Jefferson. You're like, the daughter steps in to be kind of the hostess. And it didn't work out that way. And she chose this young man who she thought had promise. I think Anna probably liked this young man because he looked like he had promise. But with her husband, Nathan, I so wanted to, you know, help him out. I so wanted to say, oh, no, everybody's misinterpreted him. It's like, oh, God, you know, he was misunderstood. No, every dog of it, he could not get out of his own way. And you did not do that. No. And I felt so bad for her. And she bet on the wrong person. But she obviously, you know, loved him at some level. I mean, she obviously loved him. They kept having the baby. She kept taking it back. She kept defending him. She wanted to please daddy so much.
So now let's talk a little bit about how Rosetta and all these women that were in the abolitionist movement affected Douglass's view of women's rights, and how, you know, we know historically how all this is all tangled up together. And for him, it was really tangled up together.
Yeah.
And so that kind of led to some problems later. Let's talk about him and women's rights and how all these relationships with women affected his views.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I tell you, that was the hardest part to really get a grip on. I mean, you'd think it would be a no-brainer, Frederick Douglass and women's rights. And it had to be, I mean, that was the last chapter I wrote, and then I had to go and rewrite the whole thing about it. And it was, that was the hardest thing. And when I started to look at, cause I was, the way I was trying to approach it, especially initially, it was, okay, Frederick Douglass participating in the women's rights movement. And what I found very frustrating was there was not a lot of there. I mean, he didn't attend a lot of women's rights meeting in kind of its early heyday of the 1850s. And a lot of that had to do with the politics of the 1850s and the politics of the anti-slavery movement. And that I found very frustrating. And, but it wasn't like, and I got a little mad at him for a while there, but then it was like, okay, wait, maybe I'm approaching this from a wrong angle. Let's look at this because it's broader than this, because everything has been broader than just the movement. You know, everything is like he approached civil rights as the personal politics. So where else is he advancing a woman's right agenda, and where is it coming from? Because, you know, he tells this great story about Elizabeth Cady Stanton accosting him in 1841. And she's actually, I looked at, like, because I'm always counting back from nine from when the babies are born, you know. So she actually was very visibly pregnant when she accosts him at this meeting. And she's telling him, women's rights, you know, women should have the right to vote in 1841. And when he's 2 months on the road as an abolitionist. So he tells a story that, like, right there at the beginning of his anti-slavery career, he's exposed to women's rights, the idea of women's rights as a movement. And he's then traveling with Abby Kelly, doing things that women don't do, which is standing up in front of a crowd, speaking to a crowd, being called all sorts of horrible names. And then I started thinking, well, he's also seen, you know, if you go back and you look at his autobiographies and he's talking about all of these women under slavery, all of these women, there's some powerful women there. And what he's encountering, you know, as a working class free black man and under slavery, it's just a very natural progression for him to understand women as equal partners. Now, how that translates into politics may take a little pushing, like from Elizabeth Cady Stanton, to say, hey, you know, this thing is right in front of you. Look at it. Women maybe should have the same political rights. And so it's a very easy push. And then when you start to look at, in a marginal movement like the very radical abolitionists, the very fringe abolitionists like they are, calling for equal rights for everyone, again, not a very far push. So when I started looking at it as something broader than just going to meetings, you know, he's coming through a civil rights agenda that's not just ending slavery, but it's also providing education and employment opportunities for not just black men, but all black people, which includes black women. This is also the agenda of the women's rights movement. So he's pushing this agenda. So yeah, he's going to push it. He's pushing it for white women as well. So he's supporting it across racial lines. When I started noticing him going to the black men's movement, he's there pushing women's rights into the black convention movement. And usually they're called black convention movements. Sometimes they're called black men's movements, but it's pretty masculine. And he's usually there explicitly saying we should include women's rights as part of our resolutions. So he's doing what we call today intersectionality. And so he's doing this, you know, he's pushing women's rights in a different angle than we're usually used to thinking of women's rights. He's still a race man. He's still very much concerned about black masculinity, especially as the Civil War comes along and then everything becomes about the dudes and men and manhood. But it's manhood is opposition to boyhood as opposed to manhood in opposition to womanhood. Womanhood is kind of a non thing, and that becomes something that women talk about.
I'm just wondering how much of this, what was the intersection between he wants he wants, there's the whole idea of, you know, of black women having the right, quote unquote, the social right to take care of their own families, their own children. Okay. Not having their children sold, you know, from them, being able to have, to take care of their own houses instead of a white woman's house. So how much does he see his, the race issue as earning for black women the same dignity and choices that white women had at that time? And how much of his extension of women's rights from social convention to something bigger, you know, a political thing? You see what I'm saying?
I think I do. It's like we usually think of, when we're thinking of women's rights, we're usually thinking of women, you know, not having to be only housewives and so
right.
forth.
But yeah. But for black women, that was
yeah.
the right to take care of your own house.
Yeah.
And have your own house.
And I, you know, and I kept trying to wrap my mind around the way they're approaching it. Because, I mean, even Elizabeth Cady Stanton, you know, in her group, are they're trying to think of it in the same way we think of it today. Black women are thinking of it in a different way. And I don't think, you know, and even when I'm looking at the whole 19th century, you know, when you are talking about, and I think this is what it ended up leaving to the modern, you know, the 20th century women's rights movement to grapple with, that we're still grappling with. You know, you want work, you want the family. How do you put those two together? Especially when all of the home work falls to the woman. How do you spread that out? And I don't think they had quite gotten to the point of realizing, because he's like, yeah, women should, you know, black women should be able to have the family and have that dignity of running their own homes and everything. And they should also be able to have, you know, jobs and education and all of this. And of course, this will translate in the traditional way, like the Republican motherhood, you know, of raising those good families. But I don't think he quite, and I don't think a lot of people at the time quite understood how do you juggle those two? And I mean, you see that with like Abby Kelly Foster, you see that with the Grimke sisters, with these abolitionist women who had these public careers, who then get married and have children. And they're like, well, we want this public career, but we also want to take care of our children and have the family. And how do you do both? And it's a very modern question.
Mm-hmm.
And what I find a lot in the 19th century is they're anticipating the things that we still fight for today. They didn't even know how to ask the questions, much less address the answers in some way.
Okay, so then we have the Civil War, the abolition of slavery, and you know there's a big battle there between women rights advocates and free African American men who now are going to get the vote.
Yeah.
So, which is a big fall. He feels very betrayed by the women's rights advocates. And then, you know, his wife, of 44 years also dies. Can you talk about, what do you think's, I mean, all this battle, he's fought all this time for the abolition of slavery. It happens. And then mm-hmm. he's very disappointed by the way white women are resentful of black men getting the vote.
Yeah.
Without them getting the vote.
Yeah. Well, I will say that, we, you know, even when I'm teaching this part of history, it's like, this was not the women's movement's finest hour. And, I mean, it wasn't his finest hour either, but it wasn't their finest hour. And what I have to, you know, when I'm trying to teach this to students especially is, sometimes when you're an activist, you have to be a reactivist in a way. You don't get to write the laws. You know, the laws get proposed. You agitate for the laws, and then the laws get written. And because of the way laws get written, sometimes you get a fraction of what you want. And so what they were given was a half measure. So do you support this half measure, or do you trash it for the whole measure? And Douglas wanted the whole measure, but they only got the half measure. And at this point, that half measure was not nothing. I mean, it was, you did have the former Confederates coming back, white supremacists coming back. You had night riders. You had people being killed in the streets. And it meant something. This voting right meant something even in the North, where black men couldn't vote in most states in the North, and then only one state didn't have property qualifications. So this was not nothing. And so, you know, he supported the 14th and 15th Amendment, half measure, and then went on to support women's rights, you know, women's suffrage. And they were willing to sell out black men, black women, uneducated men and women. I mean, it was pretty clear they were looking out just for their class. And I mean, I'm sympathetic that, yeah, women were being beaten and that they had no rights to their property and so forth. But it kind of became clear that their agenda was a little bit for themselves and a lot for themselves. And it wasn't as broad based. And so, when it came down to that, I felt like I say in the book, in some respects, he was a better woman's rights man than they were civil rights women. And I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm really glad Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony did the work they did.
Right.
But on this issue, they were wrong. And that, and you know, and he did go on to support them.
Now, you've got his wife dies, and then he's what old is he when his wife dies? 70?
Not quite 70. He's in his 60s.
Okay. And he turns around and does a real doozy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. In terms of social doozies.
Yes.
He marries Helen Pitts, a white woman.
Yes.
Which shocks everyone, not just white society, but African American people, his family. Yes. Everybody. Okay. And let's talk about that. Who is Helen Pitts? How do they meet?
Mm-hmm.
Why did they marry quickly and in secret?
Yeah.
And what it brought up all kinds of issues.
Yeah.
It was almost like it just came across to me as I read about the marriage and the ensuing scandal that it produced. That this was really a political act. Not that they didn't love each other. I'm just saying that they both saw it as a political statement. Because
absolutely.
Because she was a lot younger than he was. She was like 44 or something. She had never married. She had been very devoted to abolitionists and equal equality for African American people. And that was a huge statement for her to make at midlife.
Yeah.
To marry this and he also him after all the rumors, all the stuff that's been, you know, insinuated about him. And here he is just really giving it to him. Talk about it. It was just a phenomenal move.
Yeah. Well, it was, you know, I confess I probably love her more than I should for it to be objective. But she I probably identify her with her more than you know, maybe is objective for a historian. But no, I mean, I started off, she's kind of when you read her the biographies about him, she's kind of a nobody. I mean, and it started to annoy me because really when you read the biographies, they hold up Anna and Helen in opposition to each other. And so they stop being people. They stop being women. And their marriages stop being marriages. They start being symbols. And, you know, so here's Anna and her blackness and her illiteracy and Helen and her whiteness and her literacy. And that's not women. That's nothing, you know, that's
they symbolize a class.
Yeah. And it's and it does disrespect to what Douglas saw in each woman and what each woman brought to them in the marriage of each. And so nobody ever asked, you know, it was almost like taken for granted. Well, of course he'd marry a white woman who was, you know, educated. Like, well, why would she marry him? Because her family, I mean, her father cut her out of his will. Her family, all but her sister Jenny, really cut her off. And so I started to look, and nobody had really bothered to look much into her background. They had her, one historian had her attending Hampton University. One had her teaching Hampton. Neither one of those institutions existed until after the Civil War. So when I started looking into her, and I found out she was one of the first teachers down in Norfolk when they, you know, after emancipation, and the letters in the American Missionary Association, what she went through, I was like, wow, man, okay, this is what women did. This is how they mobilized to go show their womanhood in fighting the Civil War. She went down there and she taught freed people. She taught free people who sold black soldiers, you know, who had been slaves to read. I mean, that it ruined her health. Like, it ruined a lot of people's health who went down to do that. And that was, I was like, I really admired that. And so it made sense. Yeah, somebody who would do that, who really put her life on the line for a cause, would attract him. And then it would be very aware that what she's doing when she marries a black man is going to be making a huge statement. And she had been among freed people. This was something that was more real to her. Black people were more real to her. They weren't, you know, minstrel show characters or curiosities. This was something she had put her life into. So, you know, of course they would have a meeting of the minds. And then they seemed to have a lot of interests in common. And then she was past childbearing age. And so there was not really, or I'm assuming she was past childbearing age. She didn't produce any children. And so there really wasn't that much of a threat of more little Douglases coming along to complicate inheritance later. And companionship. I thought it was always funny that Rosetta thought her father was too old to get married again. All of that was done for him. And it's like, that's a pretty vital guy.
Let me ask you about when Helen, after Douglas dies, she does do a lot of work to preserve his papers.
Yeah.
And she really kind of got crossways with his children about the inheritances, right? Yeah. Because he left her something.
Oh yeah, he left her a third of the house and all of his papers and books. So they had already, I mean, it seems clear that they were already expecting her to preserve his papers and books, you know, kind of as his legacy, which is what you expected the wife to do. And she hit up on this idea of turning his home into something like Mount Vernon, which was cutting edge for that period of time. I mean, Monticello was not a museum. None of the president's homes were museums, just Mount Vernon, which was just up the river. So why not have a black Mount Vernon? You know, a house museum dedicated to the abolitionist movement and the fulfillment of American freedom, told through the story of Frederick Douglass, you know, a man who rose from slavery to these heights. Literally, if you go to the house, you're on a hill and you can see the Capitol across the river. And so this was a cutting edge in terms of museums and preservation. So the children, you know, were really in the mainstream to say, no, just sell the house and we'll split the proceeds. We need the money. So she had to buy them out of their shares so that she could kind of fulfill this. And they had made their position known. So she said, okay, I'm going to be proceeding with this on my own. And that led to conflict.
Now, when you're putting this whole story together, it's really, there's so many details here. There's so much stuff that I didn't even know that I think I'll never read Douglas the same again. Okay. So how do you feel, what do you think that how your book will be useful, not just by social historians and historians of abolition, but, you know, all kinds of historians who really look at his work? I think it frames his work very different. I think it sheds a lot of light. So how do you hope it will be useful? And how does this story that you've written, how does it change the overall narrative or vision or image of Douglas?
Oh my goodness. I'm still a little too close to it to see the whole big picture of like how I'm, you know, you get so into it. Details kind of overwhelm me. But, you know, one, I hope it, Douglas, to see him as a man, and I don't mean knock him off his pedestal, see him as a man, but see him as this man, real man who had these real relationships and, you know, made these decisions and whose politics were shaped by these human relationships. And quite often I read biographies and I feel like there's a push and pull between great man and not great man off his pedestal, you know, humanize him by making him
small.
Yeah. And it's like, no, he was a great man, but he was a man. And you to see him through the people who were just as fascinated and frustrated by him, and to understand that he didn't just get up there and happen. You know, he didn't just come full form. There were all of these people who created him, and these female people who created him and who influenced him and who were, I don't want to say dialogue, but, you know, there was these interactions and these relationships that shaped him.
And I think that there's more work to be done on looking at all these, some of the intellectual women friends, to see how much of their ideas interacted with his ideas, how he changed them, how they changed him and he changed them, you know, this interaction, because I think that it hasn't really been explored.
No.
And I think that would be a really great line of work.
Oh yeah. I feel like I shortchanged that because I was, you know, I was looking more kind of like the physical part. I mean, like the materialist part.
Right. Right.
And I think that's going to be an element of the next one, because, I mean, a lot of to look how they would influence each other intellectually, that was going to take a whole other set of skills and research that was going to, well,
absolutely.
Become. And I want to, you know, I'm kind of interested in following him, that whole trip to Europe with his second wife. And that's a whole deal about him being an intellectual. So I think that part will play into that. Well, I also kind of want somebody to pay me to follow in his footsteps, but
yeah. Well, there's all kinds of questions that your work brings out, all kinds of women that need to be more attention need to be paid to them. So mm-hmm. Leah, you've been very generous with your time. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
And thank you to our listeners for tuning in to another edition of New Books in Gender Studies. You can contact me through my website at www.lilianbarger.com. This is your host, Lillian Barger.